From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Voters go to the polls in seven states. We'll look at some of the nation's most interesting primaries in the small but powerful state of New Jersey. We'll hear from a congressional candidate who's a consumer activist and from an activist who's skeptical of congressional candidates.
You know, with all the talk of democracy and progress and all these other things that happen around election time, you know, many of these elections remain by default all white primaries. In New Jersey, a few years ago, we just elected the first black congressman since there was a state of New Jersey, since the American Revolution.
That and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now!, Public Broadcasting's only daily election show. I'm Amy Goodman. It's the busiest congressional primary day of the year so far, featuring a former weather forecaster in Iowa, an admitted burglar, wife beater, and deadbeat dad in Montana, and open Senate races in New Jersey and Alabama. Meanwhile, in Alabama this week, another church burning, making at least number 27 in attacks on black churches since January 1995. In New Mexico, the Green Party is one of the most successful Green parties in the United States. In 1994, the party gained credibility when former Democratic Lieutenant Governor Roberto Mondragon ran for governor as a Green and took 10% of the vote. The New Mexico Green Party has since qualified for major party status and will choose its candidates in today's primary, as Cindy Simmons reports.
Two New Mexico Greens want to unseat Republican Senator Pete Domenici, their former Green Party state co-chair Abe Gutman, and Sam Hitt, the founder of a regional environmental group called Forest Guardians. In the 1st Congressional District, law student John McCall and social worker Jack Urich are competing for the chance to run as a Green against incumbent Republican Steve Schiff. The contested primaries are a sign of growth in the New Mexico Green Party. One Green was appointed to the state school board, Santa Fe has a Green city councilor, and in March, a Green toppled a longtime Democratic incumbent for a Santa Fe judgeship. Who are the New Mexico Greens? It's a big tent. Mondragon was a Democrat when he held office. Peggy Helgeson, the only Green candidate for New Mexico's Corporation Commission, used to be a Republican. Senate candidate Sam Hitt is a hardcore environmentalist.
I have a personal commitment to defend Earth that comes from the realization that we're, in fact, defending ourselves. I see the survival of every living thing as a measure of how much we care for the Earth. Those are my fundamental core values. And the question for our times is, can, in fact, people prosper and be secure without trashing the environment?
Senate candidate Abe Gutman, on the other hand, pushes social issues in his stump speeches.
My role as the first senator who is not part of either warring faction will be to open up an historic opportunity for national reconciliation, renewed devotion to public service, and planetary healing.
Gutman says just having a Green primary will offer a positive choice for a change.
In 1994, many people in New Mexico who had been chronically cynical about the political system registered and voted only because the Green Party was on the ballot. Many people thanked us for giving them something to vote for a change, instead of having to choose the lesser of two evils. I believe that this race for the seat that has been long held by Senator Domenici is an especially good opportunity for New Mexicans to vote their hopes rather than their fears. Democrats have traditionally written off this race as unwinnable. Every 6 years, they run token candidates half-heartedly, and the public has responded by giving those candidates less than 30% of the vote. There is nothing half-hearted about the Green Party or its candidacies. And our motives are nothing less than seeking a way to establish true participatory, multi-party democracy and to bring some light to a very dark political process.
Some progressive Democrats say the Greens are taking votes away from left-leaning Democrats who have a chance to be elected, but New Mexico Greens are trying hard to avoid being spoilers. They say they want to build coalitions with other parties. For Pacifica Network News, I'm Cindy Simmons in Albuquerque.
One of the hottest races in the United States is the battle for the Senate seat being vacated by retiring Senator Bill Bradley. Pacifica reporter Thomas Martsall of station KFAI spoke with Bradley on a recent visit to Minneapolis. Even though he's retiring from the Senate, Bradley told Martsall that he's not leaving public life.
If you're a conscientious senator and your committees, subcommittees, and caucuses, and back and forth to your state representing your people, you are in a very time-consuming job, and you don't have time to do other things that are in the public interest, such as build a grassroots movement for fundamental campaign finance reform, or such as thinking through what's the next chapter in this American story in relation to the economic transformation and its impact on middle-class Americans, and in relation to the search for something that is deeper than the material. I think that also people tend to view politics in a snapshot fashion. In 6 months from now, you could easily have the Congress Democratic. I mean, I think that that's how gross the miscalculation was on the part of the Republicans. So my decision is not based upon the Republicans, because I think they want to be in control of the next Congress. My decision is based upon what I think I can, where I think I can make the biggest contribution, given my talents and skills, having made an 18-year contribution in the United States Senate.
Well, you touch upon, you mentioned campaign finance reform, and but why is it that in the almost 18 years that you've been in the Senate, there hasn't been any major reform? The last major reform to take place was 1975. Cosmetic changes, yes, but nothing really substantial.
Well, for the last 10 years, I have proposed and offered public financing of elections, and we never got enough votes. And it is partly that experience that made me realize that if we're going to get fundamental campaign finance reform, it is not going to happen in Washington. It will happen only after there is a kind of movement built on the outside that will make it politically acceptable for people to be for fundamental campaign finance reform. Right now, people oppose public financing or the kind of reform that I've fought for a decade because there's no downside to it. Because they don't think they lose by opposing campaign finance reform. They only will fear opposition when there is enough movement in states passing referendums, sending messages that, look, we want money reduced and we want the role of money reduced.
What role can government play in improving the situation of the average Joe or Jill American that they find themselves in today, especially when the public attitude towards government appears to either be very apprehensive or outright negative and hostile? I mean, when the average American finds themselves, you know, having to work two jobs or even three jobs just to bring home enough money to pay the mortgage and send the kids to school, and you come to them and say, look, you got to get involved in your church club, your civic organization, your neighborhood block club. I don't have time.
Well, in many cases, they don't have time. But the real question is, what are people who are caught in this maelstrom, who do they turn to? And at the moment, they have no one to turn to because the political kind of language and the political movement of the last two decades have told people that they're individuals out there operating on their own. But if you're the person that just lost his job at AT&T and you lost your health care and you're about to lose some of your pension benefits, who do you as an individual turn to? Who's going to help you? I mean, that is where you need public power to balance private power, because private power is going to do what is rational according to the criteria that it is, that its success is judged upon, which is the bottom line. It is going to let people go if it can maximize its profits in the short term and maybe even in the long term. That's why the way people begin to believe that public politicians are going to be relevant to their lives is when politicians are able to use public power to benefit that individual, such as saying to a company of more than 100 workers, to someone who's worked for that company for longer than 10 years, if you're downsized out of a job, then the company's going to have to pay for your health care for your family for at least a year. And pensions have got to be portable.
Racial healing and racial issues are a major issue in your biography, in your autobiography. Despite the Million Man March or the infamous trial from last year, race is not a major issue so far in this campaign. Why not? Can Americans gain from understanding each other better in their differences and their similarities?
Well, I think that that is clearly one of the most important issues for the country to work through. I mean, slavery was our original sin. Race remains our unresolved dilemma. And I think that these issues are not easy. But the time to address them is in the presidential campaign. I mean, how can we as a society believe that we're going to end up with a social fabric that is not frayed and with an economy that produces the highest possible standard of living if we fail to confront the issue of race and its associated issues? The problems in many cities is family disintegration, poverty, and violence. This isn't a matter of racial accusation. This is a matter of fact. And you cannot allow a generation to self-destruct because you're afraid to tell the truth. Unless you're willing to deal with that problem directly, get out from behind the walls of denial and face it squarely, that we're not going to ultimately be as good a country and as successful a country as we otherwise could be.
Retiring Senator Bill Bradley of New Jersey speaking with reporter Thomas Martzell. Bradley and Howell Heflin of Alabama are two of the eight Democrats retiring this year. Both of their states are having primaries today. You're listening to Democracy Now! One of the more interesting primaries today is the race to replace Republican Dick Zimmer of New Jersey, who's leaving his House seat with the hopes of beating Democratic Congressmember Robert Torricelli in the race for Bill Bradley's Senate seat. One of the candidates in the 12th Congressional District is a consumer advocate. His name is Carl Mayer. He joins us on the phone right now. Carl Mayer, you chose to announce your candidacy in front of an AT&T facility, not the most bucolic backdrop. Why AT&T?
We chose AT&T because of the dramatic effect of layoffs at AT&T and other Fortune 500 companies that are sweeping the nation. As the Secretary of Labor, Robert Reich, has observed, these Fortune 500 companies have not added one net new job to the economy since 1973. And many companies are like United Technologies, which since 1990 has dropped 30,000 jobs in the United States and hired 15,000 people abroad. And what we have to do is, you were just speaking with Senator Bradley about the importance of making government more responsive to people's concerns. We announced at AT&T with a five-point job creation program, which would include things like encouraging pension funds to invest in corporations that create jobs for Americans. We also believe that we should do more to liberalize corporate laws such that executive compensation is linked to job creation rather than simply to profitability. Finally, I'm in favor of changing the investment rules to allow investors that invest in companies where a majority of the jobs are in the United States to receive a break on their capital gains tax. These are innovative ideas, I think, that we can put in place in government to show that the priority should be jobs, good jobs at good wages for the citizens of the United States, not simply rewarding corporate special interests in government.
Carl Mayer, we're also joined by Juan Gonzalez, my co-host, in our New York studios at WBAI, and Juan certainly has written extensively in the Daily News about corporate responsibility.
Mm-hmm. How are you?
Yes. Good morning. I was especially interested in some of your program points about the issue of pension funds, and you're seeking to try to get changes at the Securities and Exchange Commission if you were elected on the way that pension funds can be invested. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, this is the largest, as you know, the largest source of capital in the economy, and the problem with the pension funds is similar to the problem with corporations, is that the citizens of the United States and retirees own this source of capital, but it's controlled by others. And what we want to do is democratize these sources of capital and allow them to be able to invest with the criteria of job creation, not simply profitability. And then it would be up to the members, those who have invested in the pension funds, to decide whether they will reward with their retirement dollars companies that are providing jobs in the United States. That's the thrust of our proposal. The SEC currently and there's various state regulations as well, don't allow these pension funds to consider job creation and other social factors in their investment.
I should say that Carl Mayer is currently a Princeton Township committeeman. By the way, President Clinton is going to Princeton today to address the university, a commencement address. Carl, I saw your piece, or the piece 60 Minutes did on you a few weeks ago that mm-hmm. followed your op-ed piece in the New York Times last summer called The Importance of Being Anyone at All. Mm-hmm. It was about the importance of money. Can you talk a little about your experience as a low-level politician in New Jersey when it comes to money?
Mm-hmm. Well, the problem is pervasive. The reason I wrote the piece was because the first invitation that I got upon being elected to office was to an annual meeting of all elected officials in the state of New Jersey in Atlantic City. As I wrote in the New York Times piece, convening in Atlantic City to study municipal government is a bit like convening in Times Square to study the problem of virtue. It's just not a terrific location. And to top it all off, the meeting in Atlantic City, which all elected officials in New Jersey attended, was funded by the taxpayer. So it's like corporate welfare for Donald Trump and the casino owners. And the purpose of the meeting ostensibly is to study public policy, but actually, when you get down to Atlantic City, you find that the primary purpose is for the lobbyists, the utility lobby and the energy lobby and the banking and insurance lobbies, to fet the politicians with junkets and parties and try to influence them. And this goes on too much at all levels of government. We have to do something to stop it, to restore faith in public life, as Senator Bradley just suggested. Other states have tough laws on the books dating back to the progressive era. For example, in Wisconsin, it's illegal even to give a cup of coffee from a lobbyist to a politician. Now, imagine if we had those standards of probity here in New York and New Jersey. It would be a totally different political experience. And you also wouldn't get the billions that are wasted every year on corporate welfare because the lobbyists are so much a part of the process. And probably one of the more amusing examples, which gave lie to the proposition that these meetings at casinos are educational for politicians, was that one of the meetings at the Atlantic City Casino was entitled Radioactive Waste and You, Perfect Together. Now, can you imagine? This is supposed to be an educational function for elected officials, and instead you've got a seminar led by members of the utility industry explaining how if your town would take a few million dollars, they're happy to put radioactive waste in your town. Now, no wonder people are a little turned off to government. Well,
Mr. Mayor, we have here with us also in New York Bob Henley, a journalist who has covered New Jersey extensively, and he's got a couple of questions for you.
Sure. Lest we make the same mistake as 60 Minutes, you have opponents in this primary, a Lambertville mayor, David DelVecchio, and Rush Holt, who's an assistant director at the Princeton Plasma Physics Lab. One of the things I'd like you to comment upon, according to the Star Ledger reporting, you have some $358,000 as a campaign war chest. It's a loan that you made to yourself. Is that accurate?
Well, not all of it is a loan that I made to myself. I made a loan to myself in the campaign. We've been raising funds from individuals, not from corporate PACs or any PACs at all. I have made a loan to myself, and we hope to pay that loan off through individual contributions.
I understand that Mr. DelVecchio had some $9,000 in his campaign chest. I mean, pretty much you have the tremendous spending advantage, although DelVecchio, apparently, according to the Ledger, has the endorsement of the political machine. Is that accurate?
That's right. He's got the political machine endorsement. Unfortunately, these campaigns, as extant, are very expensive to run, and it's unfortunate, which is why we've been the only campaign in the race advocating a serious proposal for fundamental campaign finance reform. Some of which are similar to Bill Bradley's proposals, like a constitutional amendment to limit spending on campaigns, but we also have to do much more.
Well, you're not a leftist, Mr. Forbes, then, right?
No, not at all. I'm not even in the same league.
Carl, we're going to have to go, but I just want to ask you, since this is primary day today, what are you doing?
Well, actually, I'm out here at a polling booth, which is where I'm calling you from, in the Clearbrook development in central New Jersey, talking to voters. And we're explaining to them how it's important to do something about the high utility rates that they pay out here in their developments, because out in New Jersey, they're about the second highest in the nation because of all these nuclear utilities that were built but don't work, and the costs are passed along to consumers.
Well, Carl Mayer, we want to thank you very much for joining us. Princeton Township Committeeman, running for the 12th congressional seat of Dick Zimmer. He is vacating it so that he can run for the seat of retiring Senator Bill Bradley. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back with Juan Gonzalez and journalist Bob Henley in just a minute. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host in New York, Juan Gonzalez, columnist with the Daily News. Also, Bob Henley, who writes for the New Jersey Monthly, also the New York Times, the New Jersey section, as well as the Village Voice. We're also joined by Bear Atwood, who's president of the New Jersey chapter of the National Organization for Women. The National Organization for Women supported Christine Todd Whitman in a move that surprised many, although they are now suing her over the issue of welfare. We're going to talk about that in just a minute. But I want to start with you, Bob Henley, talking about New Jersey and its significance in the country. I mean, it doesn't have the most electoral votes, but in terms of national significance, the politicians are flocking there. I mean, President Clinton there today at Princeton University. Bob Dole just made a second trip there in the last few weeks.
And it's going to make another one later in the month, Amy.
Well, I think it has to do with the density, because you can also pick up a lot of campaign loot here very quickly. You just keep working that Garden State Parkway and the Turnpike, and you can leave with millions.
Well, the other thing that it seems to me is that New Jersey has always been one of these swing states that if you don't have to go very far to get into the heartland of America, just cross the Hudson River, because New Jersey votes very much like Iowa or other heartland states. And that's the reason why, for instance, President Clinton has already been here three times. This will be his fourth trip. Dole is making another one at the end of the month. They see this as a critical signal of which way the rest of the country will be going.
It's also parallel the nation in the sense that last election was the first time, general election, presidential election, the majority of voters were in suburbia. And this is a key shift in the paradigm. And so New Jersey is kind of a microcosm of that. We have these major cities that are losing population and losing political clout, ongoing massive federal and state corruption probes of those old urban political machines, and this blooming suburban voter that I think Bill Bradley referred to at an event I was at. He said that Christy Todd Whitman was the head of a new group called a new grassroots movement called the Angry Rich.
Go ahead, Juan.
I'm sorry, Amy, but with the presidential race obviously pretty much decided in terms of the two parties, the focus is now shifting to a lot of the local races, especially some of the congressional races in Jersey. Could you tell us about some that seem to be the most important?
Sure. I think that one of the things is that the battle for the soul and heart of the Republican Party is being played out, particularly in the district where Zimmer had been, because that's, you know, while we gave a lot of airtime to Mr. Mayer, the 12th district that Zimmer was from has a pretty strong Republican leaning. And in that race, you see the candidates trying to out-conservative each other. We also see another very interesting race where Marge Rokema up in Bergen County, who's kind of led the way in this reconsideration of the Republican Revolution. Remember, she was the woman who broke with the party surrounding the leave bill that George Bush wouldn't sign in terms of, you know, the sick leave bill. That was way back. And then more recently, she's cut her own territory when it comes to the environment. And indeed,
she's
the New Jersey delegation. Right. And she is, what's interesting is that she's also the dean of the delegation, but she's being challenged by people that say that she's not a real Republican because of the fact that she's only voted with the GOP 71% of the time. So there's some real litmus tests being applied locally. And then, of course, we do have a Holocaust revisionist running on the 11th District Democratic line, trying to challenge Rodney Frelinghuysen, who's an incumbent from the center of the state, Morris County.
Running, saying the Holocaust didn't exist?
And also, you know, basically talking about the Trilateral Commission and international conspiracies. And last time, actually, the Democratic organization was so anemic in Morris County that this guy was smart enough to throw off the regular organizational candidate off the ballot and actually inspired a write-in campaign by people to reclaim the party organization line.
Bob Henley, you did a piece in New Jersey Monthly called The Money Men, Who Are the People Who Grease the Wheels of Politics with Cash, about professional fundraisers. And New Jersey really is also a microcosm there of power in the Republican Party. Can you talk a little about what this money, what role this money is playing?
Well, I think it's both parties. I think at this point in the last gasp of the 20th century, we see that both parties are involved with what I refer to as a two-party bilking system. We have Lawrence Bathgate, who is Republican National Finance Chair, really got his start working for Tom Kaine. He's an attorney from the center of the state.
Tom Kaine, former governor of New Jersey.
Right. And what's interesting is that it was in New Jersey that this attorney, Lawrence Bathgate, learned the ability to retail access. That is to say, he'd have these events for $1,000, where 4,000 people would come to a large tent and meet Henry Kissinger and meet the governor. And then this came to the attention of the National Party leadership, and he was immediately picked up into national circles. And really, the Democrats continued the same kind of thing. We had President Clinton come to New Vernon, Morris County, to meet with Arthur Goldberg, who's had an event for $25,000 a couple, and he's the head of Bally Gaming. So, you know, it's really ubiquitous, and both parties do it.
What about the way that candidates, or rather media consultants for candidates, make their money and the direction that pushes campaigns in?
Well, exactly. This is why it's so appropriate to discuss it in Democracy Now! 80% of the campaign dollars that are spent go to the media. And in a little kind of insiderish arrangement, the campaign consultants and strategists receive 17.65% from the media for every buy they make of radio and TV time, much like they're selling toothpaste. So there's a built-in economic incentive for them to go electronic media because they're going to make a bigger paycheck.
Rather than grassroots.
What's the influence of Atlantic City and the gaming industry on the politics of the state and on some of these local candidates?
I think that some people could argue that it's which vice you think you can get away with. You know, Clinton has done successfully the thing of making demonizing tobacco and saying you shouldn't take money from those interests. And so the Democrats, I guess, have decided that gambling is okay. But it has a tremendous impact, Juan. I think that we see a situation now where Steve Wynn is getting all kinds of special treatment. He's spread around, you know, six-figure campaign resources. And Trump does it as well. And it certainly hasn't delivered. The whole idea of Atlantic City was not supposed to be a delicious payday for politicians. It was supposed to improve the quality of life in Atlantic City and in New Jersey, and I don't think that's happened yet.
You know, according to the Federal Election Commission, two of the most hotly contested races, we've got the seat for Robert Torricelli, you got the seat for Dick Zimmer, and then you've got them who would like to be the next senator of New Jersey. They have raised among the most in the nation for their races, both Torricelli and Zimmer.
Yeah, I think the other thing that you have to look at here is that the problem with this is, you know, I've talked to a lot of the people that make their living this way, and they go like, well, what scandal? You know, where's Bebe Rebozo? Where's the off-island deposits? Where's the Watergate? The whole thing is a scandal, and the media participates in it, because what it does is a process of natural selection. Politicians now have to surround themselves with people with that kind of disposable income, which slants their entire worldview fundamentally.
You're listening to Robert Henley. He is he's written an interesting piece in this month's New Jersey Monthly called The Money Men. Juan, I just wanted to bring Bear Atwood into the conversation. Bear Atwood, president of the New Jersey chapter of the National Organization for Women, who will shed some light on a story that does get national attention. We see it in Wisconsin. We're seeing it in New Jersey. And that's the issue of Governor Christine Todd Whitman, also the former governor, Jim Florio, and welfare. Bear Atwood, you occupy an interesting position. You're head of NOW and NOW supported Christine Todd Whitman, to the surprise of many, yet you're suing her now.
Well, actually, we started the suit under the Florio administration, and we're suing New Jersey, the state of New Jersey, over the family cap. Interestingly, our appellate arguments will be next week. But we really, part of the reason that we chose to recommend Christine Todd Whitman was because we thought that she would take another look at the family cap.
Explain what the family cap is.
It's an exclusion. A woman who is on welfare in New Jersey, if she has an additional child while she's on welfare, her benefits will not increase. Under the old law, if you had another child while you were on welfare, your benefits increased by $64 a month. Under the current law, what we call the family cap, if you have an additional child while you're on welfare, you will not get that additional $64 a month. The stated purpose of the law was to try and hold women responsible and keep them from having children while they're on welfare. There's no real evidence that that has been of any great success. There is a lot of evidence that a lot of children have suffered as a result of not getting that very small additional amount of money into the family income.
So what are you suing on the grounds of?
Well, we've really made some constitutional arguments that the law restricts women's reproductive rights, the right to make a decision about when they want to have children. We've raised arguments about that it may, in fact, coerce women to having abortions, which, you know, obviously, although now takes a pro-choice stance, we don't think anyone should be coerced into having an abortion. And it also really doesn't serve any legitimate state goal. It's really a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution because it only impacts on the woman who is having the child, although, as we all know, it takes two people to have a child, it unfairly sanctions the mother, not the father of the child. So on a variety of...
Have you found the politicians of both parties, of both major parties, rallying to continue to support this provision? Or do you see any, especially any that are running in the race in the elections today, opposing and seeking to repeal this provision?
At a national level, both parties are rallying to continue this. The Clinton welfare proposals would keep it, as obviously would all the Republican proposals. Some of the people running in local congressional campaigns are not in favor of it. In the 11th District, Chris Evangel, who's running as a Democrat, has come out against it. In Torricelli's current district, both Bob Gordon and Rothman have come out against it.
What about Congressmembers Bob Torricelli himself, as well as Dick Zimmer?
I don't know what their positions on it are. We haven't spoken to them directly about it because neither of them really face primary challenges. We haven't interviewed them yet. But I suspect that both of them will follow their party lines.
In fairness to now, wasn't it the what happened that Whitman actually, when Florio got behind this provision in the heat of the campaign, that Whitman gave you some sense of comfort by asking him, well, what's next, interment of the poor?
Right.
Didn't she really give you good reason to believe that she would be in your corner?
Absolutely. She told us she would take a second look at the family cap. She also campaigned strongly against several other welfare provisions that the Florio administration was insisting on, things like insisting that to receive welfare, mothers absolutely had to name the father of the child, and which she came out strongly against. She now supports that. She's really done quite an about-face on welfare, and we thought that she was at least open to serious discussion and to being educated on the issue.
Do you see any chance here to broaden the coalition? I understand that Chris Smith, the Republican, very adamant, right to life in New Jersey, Republican, quite conservative, that there's been some concern from that quarter that this could increase abortions. Have you seen any kind of consensus or common ground around the idea of supporting young children?
Well, I think that there's certainly a concern about that. And I think that, for example, you know, it's a rare thing to see now working with the Catholic Church on an issue. But I think they bring that perspective of grave concern about the fact that it will increase abortions and have, you know, we've been working closely on trying to overcome and educate people about why this is a bad law. So, yes, I think that it will bring some unusual coalitions as well.
Is there any indication yet, because the law now has been in effect for a couple of years now, is there any indication of the impact it's had, either in terms of the numbers of women or families that have been denied additional benefits? Do you have any kind of studies that have been done so far?
Yeah, we do. There are two studies that have been done about percentages of birth rate, and they're directly in contradiction to each other. One says there's been no impact on the birth rate, and one says it's fallen by about 12%. But in real numbers, of the 35,000 children born to welfare mothers since August of 1993, which is when the law went into effect, 15,300 are now ineligible for that $64 a month benefit. So we know that there are 15,300 children who have been impacted, and it will grow by about 500 children a month being impacted by this law. A lot of children.
Vera Atwood, does this mean, since you are suing the current governor, Christine Todd Whitman, does this mean that you will not be supporting her when she runs again if she isn't picked to be the vice presidential nominee for running along with Bob Dole?
Well, you know, New Jersey has a PAC, and I can't speak for the PAC, but I will say that welfare is a very important issue to now New Jersey. It's an issue that impacts women very very strongly, and so this will certainly be of great concern to our PAC, and will be an issue they look at very carefully. So I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't support her in the future, but I can't speak for the PAC.
I wanted to switch to Bob Henley for a second, journalist with the New Jersey Monthly and other publications. Bob, we haven't talked too much about the race for Torricelli's seat. Now, if Torricelli were to lose for Bill Bradley's seat, this would end a very long career in Congress. But what about what's going on in the 9th Congressional District?
Boy, is it nasty, boy. The media guys are so happy with this, they're just throwing money at all news radio. We've got Bob Gordon, former mayor of Fairlawn. And then we have Steve Rothman, former mayor of Englewood, two pretty considerable cities when you look at the electoral picture. Rothman is closer to the political hierarchy, and Gordon is running himself as a reformer. It's pretty nasty. Also, we might add that Dick Zimmer does have opposition today. We are seeing this litmus test of the Republicans played out with Mr. DeHame, a freeholder from Passaic, and Dick LaRosa, Senator LaRosa out of Mercer County, both vying to take Zimmer out. And I think they might do a little bit better than the general media is expecting, because this is turning into this kind of, as I said before, who's really a true conservative.
And what about go ahead, Juan.
Doesn't Donald Payne, the newer congressman, fourth-term incumbent, have
opposition? And it's a pretty interesting story that the mainstream media has missed, except for The Ledger. Cecil Banks, 48, out of Orange, he's an attorney, a Democratic fundraiser, considered a real comer in the sense he's very dynamic. And he's challenging Payne, who is head of the Black Caucus, surrounding issues of, the whole issue of Payne's support of the Nation of Islam, the question of how much he's traveled outside of the district.
Isn't Cecil Banks challenging Don Payne's trips to Africa?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And it's interesting because it seems to also be a play out of the Sharp James machine, in the sense that, at least according to the press, Banks is supported by Sharp James.
Well, we are going to talk more about New Jersey politics and grassroots level, because we're going to be going on to Larry Hamm, who is chair of the New Jersey Coalition for the Million Man March. I want to thank you very much for joining us, Bob Henley, with the New Jersey Monthly. You can pick it up and see his piece called The Money Men, which applies to races all over the country. And also Juan Gonzalez, thanks for joining us from New York. Bear Atwood has also been with us, president of the New Jersey chapter of the National Organization for Women. You're listening to Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. So far today, we've talked mainly about electoral politics on this primary day. Now we're going to talk about grassroots organizing in New Jersey with Larry Hamm. As a high school student, he was the youngest member of the Newark School Board at Princeton University. He led the fight against university investment in South Africa. And now he's moved to head two major organizations, the People's Organization for Progress and the New Jersey Million Man March Coalition. Larry, in 1967, Newark witnessed some of the worst riots in the country. A few years later, you became member of the school board. Can you talk about Newark then and Newark today?
Well, that's very interesting. I actually grew up in the community where the riots broke out in 1967.
Why the riots then?
Well, you have to remember what it was like in the 60s. By 1967, there had been a number of riots in urban areas across the country, and most of them started by incidents of police brutality, which was the case in Newark. A black cab driver was beaten by some Newark police, and that caused a chain reaction of events that caused explosion in Newark in 1967.
You see the condition we're living in? You see these houses here? And the people who own these houses don't live in Newark. They live up in Maplewood, fancy neighborhoods and stuff, and they don't have no rats, no roaches. The garbage man come every other day in their neighborhood. Down here, the garbage man come once or twice. You understand?
But do you think it does any good to turn the neighborhood into the way this one looks tonight?
Yeah. What
do you think will happen because of this?
Nothing. The white man is going to listen downtown.
One of the worst riots in the country that left about 27 people dead in the aftermath.
The city in those sections is apparently still in what can only be classified as open rebellion.
Move, get your house.
Why do you people talk like that? I'm
just
not doing anything.
There's been people killed here today.
Yeah, but I mean, I'm not doing anything.
Now get in your house.
You talk like your dog talking to dog. That's a shame.
I want everybody off Springfield Avenue. Now, I want you to know what you're doing. You got weapons. Your life is in jeopardy. Use it.
National Guardsmen behind their jeeps. Police behind the corners of the buildings. More cars moving up by the moment. We can hear somebody up in the fourth floor windows where the lights are now being focused and where all the guns are aimed.
And those riots occurred in the community that I lived in the Central Ward of Newark. I grew up in Newark and have lived most of my life in Newark, and I have seen that community go through transition. Seen some very positive things happen. One of the first, if not the first, Black Power Conference occurred in Newark and was organized by the Committee for Unified Newark, Newark, as it was called under the leadership at that time of Imamu Baraka, who's known now as Amiri Baraka, a.k.a. Poet Playwright Leroy Jones. They had the first Black Power Conference in 1966, which led eventually to the Black and Puerto Rican Convention of 1969, which put together a slate of candidates to run for the office of the mayor and the city council. And that led to the election of Ken Gibson and several other black councilmen, one of which, who was elected then, is now the current mayor of Newark, Sharp James. I saw the city government move from an all-white institution to now an all-black institution. I can remember when there were only four black councilmen. Now the majority of city council is black. We had an appointed board of education, which became a majority black board after Gibson, the mayor, was elected, and he appointed people. And then we changed that to an elected board of education, black superintendent of schools. And since that time, the state has come in, disbanded the municipal board of education, and put in a state-appointed board. The state of New Jersey has taken over the Newark school system because, well, ostensibly for the reason that the system was in such bad shape, and it is in bad shape. I've seen the whole transition, and I have to say that in many ways, in 1996, Newark is in worse shape
than it was in 1967 or 1971 when I was appointed to the Board of Education. Now, when I say that, does that mean that no good things have happened? No, it doesn't mean that. Has some housing been built? Yes. Have some black people been employed who would have not been employed? Yes. Have some good things happened in the school system? Yes. The problem is you have, as one urban economist described it, a phenomenon of both dynamic and deterioration going on at the same time. And the deterioration outdistances the dynamic. In other words, housing continues to deteriorate faster than new housing can be constructed. The unemployment rate in urban areas structurally remains 2 to 3 times, probably in Newark, maybe 3 to 4 times the national average. Newark probably has more people receiving some form of state and federal assistance than any other city in the state. It's a city primarily, as many of our cities are becoming, reservations of the poor. Talk of urban renaissance and urban pioneering notwithstanding. You just look at downtown Newark. When I was a child, even though the city was more racially segregated at that time, I mean, there were some parts of the city you just did not walk through as a black person. Now, I don't think there's any part of the city like that, but, you know, you could go downtown and there were maybe 8 or 9 major department stores. It had a thriving economic district down there. That is no longer the case. Most of the major department stores have left. Much of the housing that was rateable, that was taxable, abandoned buildings all over the place, or if not abandoned buildings, vacant lots. Some, you can go in certain places in the city and just see whole blocks that just look like fields, flattened fields, because the housing was torn down, and you have to tear down abandoned housing. But in many cases, the communities that I would have loved to have lived in as a child in Newark are now, you know, those same communities where the crime and the drugs are so bad that you have the people calling for state troopers to come in. So I think personally that things are worse today in 1996 than in many ways than they were in 1966. And again, I say that with the qualifier that, you know, some good things have happened, but the bad things are by far outnumbering the good things.
Well, as candidates have been campaigning and running for office here in New Jersey, you've been doing a different kind of organizing. Can you talk about your activities over the last month, the Million Man March that you had on Trenton, and the issues that you're organizing around?
Well, since October the 16th, the day of the National Million Man March on Washington, those of us who participated from New Jersey have continued to organize around many of the issues that were raised on that day and before that day. The first step was to keep in place the coalition that we had put together in Jersey to mobilize people to attend the Million Man March on Washington. After we returned from Washington, we had a major meeting of several thousand people at St. James AME Church, where we passed a platform of issues that we had committed to continue to work around. And there were a number of issues, and we raised those issues again when we had the New Jersey Million Man March Coalition march on Trenton on May 6th that was attended by estimates range from 3,000 to 7,000 or more people in Trenton.
This may surprise some, but this is one of the largest marches New Jersey's seen in many years.
Well, this was certainly the largest march of African Americans on the state capitol probably in the history of the state. It certainly wasn't the largest demonstration, but this was the largest demonstration of primarily African Americans to march on Trenton, and it certainly took everyone by surprise. It even took some of the organizers by surprise. We were kind of overwhelmed by the tremendous response we got from people on May the 6th. And we believe that the things that people are feeling right now is one of the motivational factors that help bring so many people out. We are continuing to organize around many of the issues that affect people who live in urban areas, primarily African Americans and Latinos, but there are certainly more people than that that live in the urban areas. We're organizing around the issues of quality education, employment. A major issue in Jersey now is an increase in the minimum wage. The minimum wage in Jersey is a little higher than the national, but nobody can make a living off of $5.05 an hour. So we're working around that. Health care, housing, crime, all of these are issues. Drugs, all of these issues we continue to organize around through the Million Man March Coalition and other organizations.
You have the advantage in New Jersey since you have a governor, Christine Todd Whitman, who is in the national spotlight, is being talked about as a possible Republican vice presidential candidate, of getting more attention than you might when you have an action like this largest African-American march on the state capital, Trenton. In fact, she came out to your march and wanted to address it. Can you talk about the politics of that and what you're demanding of the governor?
Well, again, this was something that took us by surprise. There was a request from, it seems, some of her staff people to let the governor address the crowd. And we thought that that would not have been appropriate. This was a day where primarily we wanted to send a message to our own community that now is the time for action, now is the time for people to unify and to get involved. And the leadership of the coalition was there to address that part of the community that was in Trenton and that part of the community that wasn't in Trenton. And it would not have been appropriate for the governor to speak at that time, because we had sent a message out to all the other elected officials that this was going to be an opportunity for the leadership of the coalition to address its constituency. So the governor wanted to come out and address the crowd. We didn't think that was appropriate, but we were invited in to meet with her. And a delegation of representatives of the state organizing committee and also the Black Ministers Council of New Jersey went in. We had a short meeting with the governor, making some of our concerns known. Again, the issue of affordable housing in New Jersey, specifically rental housing. A lot of the initiatives now are around constructing housing and single-family homes, but a lot of people can't buy a home. And it's very difficult now in the state to find affordable rental housing. The issue of drugs and drug rehabilitation, the need for the state to provide more facility and more beds for people who are trying to get out of that predicament of drug addiction. The question of parity, funding for our public schools, which is a major issue in the state. As you know, a couple of years ago, we had the Abbott versus Burke decision, in which the New Jersey Supreme Court officially said that funding for public schools between suburban and urban schools is unequal, and that is unconstitutional. And they had set a timetable for the state of New Jersey to both come up with a plan and equalize the funding. And the state has failed to do that. And the state may end up back in court very shortly, because I believe that the timetable goal was 1997. For equalized funding of public schools. Also, the issue of employment. We have more than 216,000 people in the state who are unemployed, and those are the people that they can still count. there are probably thousands of others who stopped looking for work, and we have the need for an increase in the minimum wage. So we have a lot of issues, you know, basic issues, many of them economic in nature, some of them racial in nature, that have to be dealt with. And we put these issues on the table with the governor, but we made it clear, since we had not actually requested to meet with her that day, that we needed to have another meeting, at which time we would specifically come back to address these issues in depth. And I believe that meeting is going to take place towards the end of this month.
Today is primary day in New Jersey. The voters are going to be choosing the Democratic nominee and the Republican nominee for Robert Torricelli's seat, for Dick Zimmer's seat, and, of course, then you have the seat that is being vacated by Bill Bradley. Mm-hmm. Does any of this, do any of these races make a difference to you?
Do they make a difference to me? They make a slight difference. I would rather see, Democrats in some of these seats than I would want to see Republicans. It's a choice of the lesser of two evils. Because, you know, with all the talk of democracy and progress and all these other things that happen around election time, you know, many of these elections remain by default all white primaries. You know, we have candidates from African-American, Latino communities just as qualified to run for these offices as anyone else. But we see year after year after year, although our populations continue to grow, we don't see our own people in a lot of these positions, particularly when we begin in New Jersey. A few years ago, we just elected the first black congressman since there was a state of New Jersey, since the American Revolution. Donald Payne is the first black congressman from the state of New Jersey. And, you know...
And what's the population of African Americans in New Jersey?
In New Jersey, it's about the same as the national rate, 12%, maybe a little more than 12%. But in the district where Payne was running, it had been a majority black district since 1972. But for some reason, the powers that be, you know, made sure we had no African-American congressmen. But we have to get to a point where we can put up our own candidates and our own platforms for these offices. It's clear even, I mean, in November we're going to choose, you know, between Clinton and Dole. And everybody in the black community knows that, you know, again, it's a choice between the lesser of two evils. At some point, we have to reach a point where we can put forward our demands and then back up our demands with our own electoral power and community power. And that is only going to happen by building viable, strong, long-lasting organizations.
Larry, thanks for joining us. Larry Hamm is chair of the People's Organization for Progress and chair of the New Jersey Coalition for the Million Man March. Special thanks to Steve Inskeep, who provided the archival sound of the Newark riot. We'd love to hear your comments on the show. Call us at 202-588-0988, extension 313, 202-588-0988. I'm Amy Goodman for Democracy Now!